Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the anniversary year of two highly influential rock albums by the undeniable ringmaster of shock rock. 18, I get confused every day. 18, I just don't know what to say. 18, I gotta get away.
I think it's because we were such a shock to the nation, image-wise. We were sort of like, I always say that we were the band that drove the stake through the heart of the love generation. Everybody was so tired of peace and love and, you know, that kind of San Francisco thing, that all of a sudden here was this breath of fresh air. Everything that the hippies didn't believe in.
Hello, you rotten little bloodsuckers. This is Alice Cooper, and I'm in the studio with Killer.
One of the most consistent things down through rock history is how misunderstood Alice Cooper has always been. You may be well aware how Alice Cooper's string of million-selling albums starting with 2 in 71, Love It to Death in February that year, and Killer in November, influenced 3 decades of rockers that followed, from Kiss in the 70s to Motley Crue in the 80s to Marilyn Manson in the 90s. But make no mistake, Alice Cooper that made Love It to Death and Killer in 1971, it was a band, not an individual back then, formed by 5 friends from Phoenix, Arizona. Their lead singer was a preacher's son named Vincent Furnier, who had been born in Detroit. The band had moved from Phoenix to L.A. after getting signed to Frank Zappa's record label and recorded 2 unsuccessful albums there, before relocating to Detroit, where the change of venue and a young, astute producer changed their fortunes. 2 hit albums resulted in 1971, and lead singer Alice Cooper has a theory on why.
I think it's because we were such a shock to the nation, image-wise. We were sort of like, I always say that we were the band that drove the stake through the heart of the love generation. Everybody was so tired of peace and love and, you know, that kind of San Francisco thing, that all of a sudden here was this breath of fresh air. Everything that the hippies didn't believe in. It was like, you know, suddenly there was Clockwork Orange. Alice Cooper was like celebrating sexuality and androgyny and horror and all of this put together, and it was fun. For the first time in a long time, music was not political, it was fun. And Alice Cooper was sort of like the biggest juvenile delinquent rock and roll horror show of all time, and people sat there and said, it's about time that something like this came along. But not only the image was there, the most important thing in our mind was the fact that the music has to stand up years from now. It has to stand up even after they forgot what we did on stage. What have I got that makes you want to love me? Is it my body? Someone I might be. Something inside me. You better tell me. It's really up to you.
With a definite Yardbirds, Heart Full of Soul moodiness to it, Is It My Body, from Alice Cooper's February 1971 album Love It to Death. The song was written by guitarist Michael Bruce, guitarist Glenn Buxton, bass player Dennis Dunaway, drummer Neil Smith, and lead singer Alice Cooper. Don't forget, this was a band that had become known not for their musical talent, but instead for their unbelievable stage antics, which included decapitated baby dolls, cross-dressing, and just about anything else that was guaranteed to cause a commotion. As a result, they had often disgusted entire audiences to the point of mass exodus. Alice fondly remembers one such occasion at a birthday concert for controversial comedian Lenny Bruce.
We played at a thing called the Lenny Bruce's Birthday Party with The Doors, Paul Butterfield, Love, all of these great bands. 8,000 people inside this place. Alice Cooper came on last. Within, I would say, 4 minutes, we had cleared the place. They could not take it. I mean, they looked at us. We started up, and we started up with a song called Out in the Street by The Who. And it was just all feedback and everything, and I had blonde hair down to my waist, and I had the blue makeup all over my eyes, and it was on. It wasn't on 5 or 6. Everything was on 11. We were Spinal Tap, you know. But, I mean, we were like everybody's rock and roll nightmare come true. And they sat there, and their mouths were open, and they ran for the door. It was the greatest reaction. There were 4 people left standing there, my manager, Shep Gordon, and Frank Zappa, and 2 of the GTOs. I think Miss Pamela and Miss Christine were standing there looking at going, what was that? And the idea was the fact that, you know, they looked at each other and said, anything with that much negative energy can be turned around. We were like beyond Darth Vader, because nobody expected it. They said Alice Cooper, and they went, oh, it must be a blonde folk singer. You know, because it's a nice, sweet name. I mean, it was like the hell had broken loose. There was this band of these guys that looked like they should really be, you know, detained somewhere in a mental hospital. But we were very serious about it. We didn't go up there for laughs. We were very serious about our music and very serious about the stage show, and it was so intense that it just blew everybody away. So we had this reputation where people walked around and said, you have got to see this band. You know, if this is the new thing, I don't know if I ever want to be in rock and roll again.
The name Alice Cooper certainly was an attention grabber. There had been many stories over the years of where it came from, including 17th century witches and Ouija boards. But after some coaxing, Alice Cooper told me the name really came from a desire to be obnoxious and irritating.
I said, and like the name, look at us. We all had hair down to our waist already, you know, and I think it was a combination of that and watching whatever happened to Baby Jane. Way Betty Davis put her eye makeup on, she just kind of took her fingers and smeared it across her eyes. And to me, I said, that's the kind of makeup that's so irritating, because it's not done nicely, it's done really crudely. And then I said, I could have said Betty Johnson or anything, but I said, what if it was like Alice Cooper? It was the nicest name I could think of, sweetest little old lady or a sweet little girl's name. I said, but, you know, it's got something to it that also is really deadly. And then we started thinking about it. Alice Cooper, Lizzie Borden, Baby Jane. It had this da-da-da, da-da-da, and it had a real theatrical thing to it. And I said, what's going to happen when they say Alice Cooper and they think it's going to be this and they get this? I said, they're going to have to talk about it. And now to this day, I mean, when I hear Alice Cooper, I still get it's still got a chill in it. It's still got it's got this maniacal little chill in it that I really like. When they hear the radio and they go, oh, wow, listen to that, 18. Wow, that really says it for the whole generation.
And hands.
Love It to Death album in 1971, I'm 18, was the song that first showed Alice Cooper could really rock and roll. Who had been born Vincent Furnier in Detroit, the son of a preacher. The fire and brimstone from the Book of Revelations may have been off limits for young Vince and his subject matter, but precious little else was.
Our heroes were the Yardbirds and the early Who. Those were the bands that we listened to and said, if we can just put our personality into that kind of sound. To me, the Yardbirds were the greatest experimental rock and roll band of all time. Now, when we started, we weren't good. It took Bob Ezrin 6 months in a barn in Detroit for us to rehearse and rehearse every day for 8-9 hours, and he totally retaught us how to play and how to sing and how to write. So he was like our George Martin. And we still, you know, we didn't want it to be polished, really polished. We didn't want to be the Moody Blues. We wanted to be Alice Cooper, you know, America's answer to the Yardbirds. And so, you know, in reality, Bob Ezrin was the most important thing to the Alice Cooper sound. We had the raw talent, we just didn't know what to do with it.
See you.
You know, we didn't try to make it that dark. It was just that we were had an overly developed sense of the dramatic. We were very melodramatic. We wanted to be the villains of rock and roll. I would say Dwight Frye should be like, when you get done hearing it, you should be wanting to tear your shirt off and just go outside and try to get a breath of fresh air. I want this to be so tense and so, I mean, maniacal that people are going to want to go out and get air afterwards. It's so claustrophobic at some points that, you know, people sit there and they go, that's really totally melodrama. That's the most dramatic thing you could. When I did the song in the studio, I was in a straitjacket. It was so tight and everything. I said, we've got to do this exactly the way that, get the feeling of what would happen if you were in a straitjacket.
Up next, why Alice Cooper will never be invited to join the Future Farmers of America. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online 24/7 at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Alice Cooper on the anniversary of Love It to Death.
Hello, you rotten little bloodsuckers. This is Alice Cooper, and I'm in the studio with Killer.
Thanks, Alice. Alice was notorious for shocking stage shows, but there is one incident for which he refuses to take the rap. It happened at a Toronto concert that included several superstars, and Alice's manager, Shep Gordon, somehow got the band on the bill.
Shep, it was at his glorious, at his best, getting us on this bill, because it was with John Lennon, Yoko Ono, The Doors, every major group, and there were like 90,000 people there. And somehow we were on between John Lennon and The Doors. To this day, I can't figure out how Shep pulled that one off. But we were totally unknown. We got on stage and we did our show the way we did it in LA. And the audience, again, we just went out of their minds. Toronto went out of their minds. They thought that this was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. At the end of the show, this is one of those great rumors. Somebody from the audience threw a chicken on stage. You know, I'm from Detroit. I've never been on a farm in my life. It had wings. It had feathers. It was a bird. So I took it and I threw it out and expected it to fly away. You know, I didn't know chickens couldn't fly. So the chicken went down in the audience and they tore it to pieces. Now, the next thing in the paper I read was Alice Cooper tears head off chicken, drinks the blood. La, 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 la. We were the talk of the musical world the next day. I got a call from Frank Zappa saying, did you do that? And I said, well, I threw the chicken in the audience. He says, well, whatever you do, keep doing it. He says it's the biggest buzz ever in rock and roll history, you know, that kind of thing. And from that time to this day, I'll go into a city and the ASPCA will be there saying, "Are you going to kill chickens?" I never killed a chicken. Under My Wheels was totally dedicated to Detroit. We were like totally loyal to Detroit because they were so loyal to us. And the Midwest was our home then. We realized that the blue collar, it wasn't called heavy metal, though, just the hard rockers, you know. But the blue collar worker kind of kid they were the ones with the black leather jackets and the long greasy hair that had their fists up every single concert and never missed a concert. And we said, this is our audience.
In August 1971, I myself saw Alice Cooper headline an outdoor festival in Northwest Ohio in a cornfield with an electric chair. He paced the low stage like a Black Panther in a cage. Barely 6 months later, with the Killer album up and out, Alice Cooper sold out the Toledo, Ohio hockey arena. I asked Alice how he went from underground cult band to the mainstream buzz in such a short time.
I think it was just the fact that once they gave us the license to be on the radio, when they played 18 and Love It to Death was suddenly, you know, in the top 20 albums, they gave us the license to kill. It's suddenly, you know, we weren't just this underground band. All of a sudden, Alice Cooper was something to be reckoned with. And our music, we just exploded then. You know, then a Killer came out and we just said, listen, we don't have to answer to anybody anymore. To us, we got everybody's attention with the horror. And to me, it was important that no matter, you know, when we get up on stage, that we just overwhelm the audience. Then we had enough money suddenly to use lights. And we had enough money to not just have an electric chair that we made, but we could actually have a gallows that really worked. And we actually would go and produce it and had a choreographer. Suddenly we sort of blossomed into the theatricality that, you know, that we could suddenly afford what we were thinking of. Before that, we had absolutely no money to work with. We had a lot of great ideas, but nothing, no money to work with. So, I mean, it was very important for us that all of a sudden somebody says, here's $200,000, build a stage. We went, all right. You know, we were like kids in a candy shop. But I tried not to lose the dark edge. That's why I think Alice always had, you know, the insanity up there. But I could see that, you know, you couldn't just live on that negativity.
But actually getting to that Toledo, Ohio headline show presented a problem.
There's a strip of hotels in Detroit on Woodward Boulevard that we would move into for like 3 weeks and then bounce a check and go to the next one. And it would go on and on and on and on and on. So we owed every hotel on Woodward money, the paper trail, because we were, you know, we were going to pay them back. We just couldn't afford it at that point. We at one point we woke up, we had a show in Toledo. We had a van, a blue van. We got out, got in the van, we couldn't get the thing going. We got out, the guy had chained the van to a big metal post. And we said, what's the matter, sir? We don't understand. Shep, of course, you know, was like the greatest. He was W.C. Fields when it came to conning people at the time. And the guy says, you've left checks bouncing all over the city. You know, he said, well, how much do we owe you? The guy says, $1,200. He took a check from Shep. The guy took a check. That's how good Shep was. And so we drove up and I said, how do we get out? He says, he took a check. And I went, unbelievable. But I want to say at this point, we went back and paid every single hotel. We sent every single hotel. Not only we sent them checks, we sent them gold albums. We sent them, because they put up with us.
Little Betty ate a pound of aspirin. She got them from the shelf up on the wall. Betty's mommy wasn't there to save her. She didn't even hear her baby call.
Dead baby.
Actually, that song was probably the first anti-drug, anti-parental abuse song, and that's how it was written. It was never meant to be the celebration of dead babies. It was like, mom is high and in the other room with some guy she'd never seen before, dad is out drinking, and the baby's taking every pill in the medicine cabinet. Dead babies can't take care of themselves. Dead babies can't take things off the shelves. It was a total anti-parent abuse song.
Goodbye.
6 years later, London's punk band The Stranglers would cop Dennis Dunaway's bass sound from Dead Babies on Alice Cooper's Killer album. But what about that line in the song, "Daddy is an agrophile in Texas"?
I could explain agrophile to you. We sat there and said, well, what would Chuck Berry do? He'd make up a word, you know? So we figured that Daddy was so messed up, he was having sex with the ground. Like, you know, dig a hole in the ground and he's an agrophile, you know?
Still to come, Alice Cooper will introduce you to his onstage assistant, Yvonne, who was deaf, weighed 75 pounds, and had no arms and legs, but she was a real killer. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Alice Cooper.
Welcome back in the studio with Alice Cooper with the one, the only, Redbeard.
Thanks again, Alice. And while Alice Cooper has clearly influenced three decades of performers, including Kiss in the 70s, Motley Crue in the 80s, Marilyn Manson certainly in the 90s, Alice Cooper was musically influenced themselves by two British invasion bands and one intrepid young Canadian producer.
You told me that Bob Ezrin spent 6 months in a barn in Detroit with your band. And it just begs the question, did he ever tell you why? After two flops, why did you get the chance to even record and release Love It to Death?
Well, it was because that he saw something in the band. He saw the audience reaction. Even without hit records, we were killing an audience. We were making an audience go, wow. And he, what his theory was the only thing you guys don't have is a handle. You don't have a handle on the music. When you hear an Alice Cooper song, you don't go, oh, that's Alice. Because the voice was like doing lots of different things. The guitar was doing lots of different things. The bass was all over the place. And he says, what we have to do is go into this barn and forget everything that you've ever done and start all over. He was George Martin. He was our George Martin. And he said, we have to invent a bass sound. We have to invent a guitar sound. We have to invent a signature Alice vocal. We have to invent a style of writing, a lyrical style, everything. And we did that. I mean, we just worked 8 hours, 9 hours a day. That's all we did. Until I always look at Love It to Death as our first album, really.
You know, yeah, and so does a lot. Do a lot of people who think they know your career. A lot of people think that is
right.
Your first record.
Yeah, and you know, the first two albums were fun, and they were sort of, I always look at that as our Zappa period. And Frank was great, but he didn't want to change anything in the band. He says, I just like you guys for what you are. I don't want to change anything. You're a bizarre, you know, oddity. Whereas Ezrin says, you're an oddity, but I think that you're something more than that. I think there's something deeper inside you guys. And that's when all of a sudden all those great songs started coming out, you know, the 18 and, you know, School's Out and No More Mr. Nice Guy, all that stuff. That was all in there. It just had to be brought out. You know, so Bob worked us hard. I mean, he was hard in the studio. He was a tough guy to work with because he really demanded a lot.
She struts into the room. Well, I don't know her. But with a magnifying glance, I just sort of look her over. Drink or two, well, maybe three. And then suddenly she starts telling me her life story. She says, baby, if you wanna be my lover, you better take me home. 'Cause it's a long, long way to paradise. Alice, I said, listen, baby, you
Oh, baby, if you wanna be my lover, you better take me home. 'Cause it's a long, long way to paradise, and I'm still on my
By February 1972, the crossover hit radio airplay of Under My Wheels and Be My Lover, combined with the word of mouth about the notorious stage show, allowed Alice Cooper to headline arenas.
You know, to me, the music was always 80% and the theatrics was 20%. So we spent a lot more time on the music than we did on the theatrics. The theatrics were just, to us, was just pure fun. I don't know where we got the theatricality, but everybody in the band, it was theatrical in their own way. I don't know, it was a magical kind of thing that everybody understood how to work that stage. It was all thought out and rehearsed, but I mean, you know, we tried to do the most outrageous stage show of all time, and I think we still do, but the music was always the first thing.
Alice began using an electric chair as a prop on his Love It to Death tour, then a gallows to hang himself, then a guillotine to chop his head off. But the stage prop that everyone remembers most is the giant boa constrictor snake.
The snake is still the easiest thing in the world to work with on stage because they love being on stage. They're deaf, for one thing. They have no hearing. And they love the warmth of the lights. They love the... They don't mind the audience at all. In fact, you know, when I put them down towards the audience, they love that. So there's really... The only thing that they are affected by is adrenaline. If you're holding a snake and it doesn't feel secure, it's going to tense up on you. It's going to wrap around because you're like a tree. It doesn't want to fall. It has no way of stopping its fall. So, everything, and they're pure muscle. And I mean, this one snake I had, Yvonne, was like, she was about 13 feet long and she weighed about 75 pounds and she was solid muscle. So if she wanted to, like, snap you in half, it would be absolutely no problem.
Co-written by Alice Cooper and guitarist keyboard player Michael Bruce, listen to the sophisticated string arrangements and the different vocal styles employed on the one song from the killer album called Desperado. Desperado was inspired by Doors lead singer Jim Morrison, who died just before this album was made.
We knew Jim in his last years, and we knew him when he was totally out of control, and we drank with him, and and we were in awe of him and everything like this because we had never met anybody quite like this guy. He didn't take the business very seriously. He didn't take anything seriously except how out of it he could get and how much fun he could have on stage, outraging the audience. And, it didn't really surprise me when he died. I mean, the guy was always jumping out of cars and stuff. And so Desperado was totally, I even did part of, I could do a good Jim Morrison imitation. I even used part of his voice on it, because I thought that we should really dedicate a song to him. The guy deserved it.
I'm a gambler, and I'm a runner. But you knew that when you laid down. I'm a picture of ugly stories. I'm a killer and I'm a clown. Step into the street by sundown. Step into your last goodbye. You're a target just by living. $20 will make. Shots are clean, my shots are final. shots are deadly, and when it's done,
you're as stiff as my smoking barrel. You're as dead as a desert night. You're a notch and I'm a legend. You're at peace and I must hide.
November 1971 album Killer, Desperado was dedicated to the late Jim Morrison of The Doors.
Jim Morrison and I, you know, I mean, we drank all the time. The Alice Cooper Band and The Doors were pretty close. And
you shared stages together.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, did a lot of stuff like that, but I certainly do remember drinking. And couldn't keep up with him, of course. I mean, he was a professional.
But, you know, seriously, you could have probably taken Morrison's place in The Doors, I believe. Ever speculate on that?
Yeah, you know, and there was a thought of that. You know, I was going to call Robbie up and say, you know, I can do all these songs. But, I mean, I was still touring on my own band at the time.
You were.
If I wasn't doing anything, I probably would have fit that bill pretty good.
No, you were the only person that I have ever thought, and you have recorded proof here on the Hollywood Vampires.
I went right for it, yeah. And, you know, I don't know why that there's a need for us to keep these people alive, you know, in on the radio. And, you know, they were our heroes as much as they were our friends, you know. In other words, when the Vampires would sit and drink, you were sitting there not just drinking with, you know, a bunch of guys. These were guys that you were fans of. You know, I mean, even though they knew that, and they were fans of mine too, which was kind of cool. You know, the fact that they knew my songs and everything. But I mean, I'm looking around the room and I'm going, geez, I've got everybody's album. Everybody in this room, I've got all their albums. You know, so you know, there is our generation. This me and Steven Tyler and Ozzy. You know, we're all the same age. And these guys were our big brothers.
Alice Cooper was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Alice Cooper. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.